Hello, my name's Richard Cox, and I'm here again today with Tim Freake on what we've decided to call a series of Deep Awake Dialogues. It was either that or the Tim and Richard show, but we couldn't decide between the Tim and Richard show or the Richard and Tim show, so we went for Deep Awake Dialogues. So in this, the third episode of Deep Awake Dialogues, I'm going to be asking Tim about his career as an author. Tim, good morning.
Good morning.
You've written, I don't know what it is, 25 books.
More.
Do you know the exact figure?
No.
Okay. Well, it's a lot
It
anyway.
is a lot.
And you started in your mid-30s, I think, with the Tao Te Ching.
Yeah.
So was being an author something you always aspired to do, or was it something you fell into at that point in life?
Kind of both and neither, I suppose. It's interesting when I look back because I feel like I was always a writer. I at school the I had an amazing experiences around teachers of English who would come and pick me out, and I remember one when I was, I don't know, 15 or something, coming up afterwards and saying, "Look, if you want help publishing some of the things you write, I'll help you." And me thinking, "Oh, that's nice." So I always had that background in writing as something which clearly people could were pointing me towards. And it interests me that after the experience I had of awakening when I was 12, which I've talked about a lot, what I did was I wrote a play. And we performed it, and it was a big deal actually in the local community because it was all kids. And so I immediately turned to writing. And then not got distracted, but I think but saw got very attracted towards music because music has this power to instantly change consciousness, and because its power in society is so large. I was very attracted towards that ability it had and the impact it was having, and being young, and so really got pulled into that as a medium. I also think there was a moment where I knew that I would end up doing what I've been doing, not just writing, but being a philosopher or specifically exploring awakening, and didn't feel up it, didn't feel I could do that, that I wasn't ready, and I wasn't ready. And so writing was something that needed to wait because I was ready to make music. I could make music about awakening, if you like. I could write music which was about consciousness changing, and I could do that, but I couldn't approach writing. So writing kind of disappeared off into the back of my mind, and my focus and my creativity was on sound. And then really life came and got me. I was doing a very big rave show, a shamanic theatrical rave show with a ridiculous cast of huge number of people and giant puppets and video, which was pretty new then, and to bring about, with music and visuals, and I poured a huge amount of energy into it, and it had been a great success and then gone nowhere, and I was exhausted, and I realized I had to stop, that I'd come to the end of the road. I'd been at it for a very, very long time. We'd been so close so many times to making it work in the way it would be sustainable. It wasn't working, so I kind of backed off. And a friend of mine was a writer, and he had an agent, and he said, "Tim, you're a writer, you should write." And he's a bit older than me, and I thought, well, maybe. And anyway, for various other reasons, I was put in touch with this agent, and I thought, what have I got I can send to her that I've written? Because I haven't written anything for years. I'd written a lot when I was younger, and I'd actually had a play put on the radio when I was younger as well, just as an incidental. But the what was the way life works, it was like I was knocking on this door, music I want to create. Behind me, there was an open door marked writer. And I just kind of turned around and wandered back through this other door. And I just thought, what have I got to send her? And what I had was I'd been writing my own version of the Tao Te Ching. And I've been doing that to set it to music because I was fascinated by sound and word. And so I couldn't find a translation that worked for me because I've been studying the Tao Te Ching since I was 15. I knew it inside out. And I wanted it to say what I knew it that I felt it was saying. So I was also hanging out and had been with people like Robert Bly, who, like Coleman Barks, had taken the works of these great poets, Rumi and Kabir, and these mystical poets, and transliterated them. They weren't translations. They weren't going back to the original language. They were working from translations, but bringing out what it really meant. And so I did that with the Tao Te Ching and worked from, like, you know, 30 different translations and really worked out, no, this is what it's saying, and presented this and sent it to this agent. And it arrived literally on her desk at the same time as another letter from a publisher saying, we want to do a series of Chinese, one who can do a poem. And she took my copy. She sent it to Martin Palmer at Manchester University, who's the top Chinese expert in the country. And he looked at it and said, this is great. This is great. So he oversaw me doing the translation. And the next thing I knew, I was a writer. And then, bang, I was off. And the agent was there going, can you write about Zen? And I was like, yeah, I can, actually.
There's a kind of progression in your writing, as I notice, because I for people that don't know, I spent some time over the past year turning Tim's books into ebooks, which we had to do right from the process of scanning them. So I'm quite familiar with them at this point. And there is this progression from...
More so than me, I suspect.
I've read them all. I've proofread them all. So there's this progression from starting off in the 90s, where you do things that are very much commenting on existing philosophies like Zen or Hinduism, or writing things like the Tao Te Ching, and doing books that are involve a lot of quotations and a lot of commentary and drawing out the meaning of what other people are saying. And then there's a progression to, in the mid part of the last decade, say, where your writing becomes very original, when you've got books like The Laughing Jesus, which incorporate like a third of it is your own thoughts, and then going to How Long Is Now, which is, you know, a sort of biographical book. Was that a good way to progress in terms of sinking into being a writer, that you've almost got like this support, you're not having to be totally original straight off the bat?
Yes, for me it was great. And also, I mean, it's so original, it's so individual, isn't it? You know, the whole journey we make. But for me, I did. So I'd immersed myself in spirituality all my life, so I knew this stuff inside out. So, and it was at a particular time where there was a great rush of spiritual books, so I could actually make a living writing books on these different traditions. So I had the delight. It was like, oh God, I can literally go, I want to write about this, and then go do write about these, all these different traditions, bringing out the perennial philosophy of oneness in them. And so it was a delight, but it was also, so in one way as a creative artist, that was like, and as a spiritual explorer, that was like, oh really? So it forced me to go, so what's the essence of Zen? So what's the essence of Sufism? So what's the essence of this? And that was a fantastic discipline. But also for me, on my own individual journey, as a musician, it had all been about my own vision. My vision, my vision, my vision, my vision. And I hadn't made it work. And it felt like there was me in the world, and we were like, you know, it was like being at the school disco, and I was on one wall and she was dancing in the middle, and I was like, no, you come to me, no, you come to me, no, you come. And eventually it was like, no, I got to go to her. So it was like, what I did was I just kind of went, okay, I will write stuff which isn't to do with me. It's my vision of what these different traditions are, but this is not just about me. This is me providing a service for other people, and I will also work with publishers who want this and want it in this format and like pictures and, you know, and all these things which maybe I don't want. And so it was a compromise. I compromised and I started making a living properly because in that way. And what was fascinating for me was that, having come to terms with that and being able to do it, then from that I arrived at the position where I could actually do what I think I was born to do, which was create my own ideas and write them. But I needed to go through that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I've heard it, this is an aside to the interview, I've heard it said like that a lot of spiritual art through the ages has, the artist hasn't had total freedom. Like if you think of ancient Egypt, there's all this incredible spiritual art there, but it's totally conformist to a standard. Yeah. 2,000 years. There's like no deviation, one little period. And people like Michelangelo or someone painting the Sistine Chapel, those great works, but they were done to the order of someone else. And so it's true through the ages, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there's something about, I needed to be willing to, certain humility perhaps, and a kind of, just a rite of transition. And so that's how it worked for me. So that when I hit those books that you're talking about, then I had a platform, and then it was like, okay, I'm ready now. Let's go. And then that's where I wanted to be. And now that's just continuing. And the work I'm doing now, it's like, I can't believe how lucky I am to make a living exploring the philosophy of life and getting to write about it like I am right at this very minute.
Okay, so I want to ask some questions that are perhaps useful to people who aspire to write something but get very stuck with that. I know that's my experience whenever I've tried to sit down and write. So just to start with, Tim, you're writing a new book at the moment. I'd just like to ask, first off, what kind of structure do you have for putting a book together, assuming it's the same every time, and it might not be. But do you have an idea in your mind of the whole book before you begin and know roughly what the chapter headings are going to be? Or is it very much an emerging process? Does the book look very different by the time it goes to the publishers from what you initially thought it might?
I start with, if there's a vision, there's an idea that I know I want to explore, and there's something which is pushing in on me. Something wants to be said. And because I know now how much work it takes, there's a little bit of resistance in me. It's like, you really want to be said? Because I've got to be committed to this, because it's going to take a lot from me. And then it's about trying to work out what that is. And part of that for me is to structure things. What are the elements of this idea? And how would I explain it? And narrative, I think, is essential in if you're doing something which is about explaining something. It's quite different, I think, to fiction and things. But narrative in that explaining sense, because often what you want to convey is something you intuitively know, but it's a total thing. It's a bit like if I tried to describe this room to you, what I want to do is go, it's like this. Mm-hmm. But I've got to go, if I've only got words, I've got to go, well, let me start by the window. The window's like this. And then you go to the right, there's the door. And then if you come around, there's the bookcase. Or should I go, I'm opposite the book? Where's the... So when you're dealing with ideas like I am, the key thing is to work out, how can I come in? How can I find a strand to touch the reader where they're going to be with me? And then feed them something which they'll come with. They'll go, yeah, I get that. And then something else, oh, I get that. And we're going here. We're going to, in my case, we're going often to things which are really woo, but we've got to get there. So, you know, each step, they have to come with me. They have to come with me. They have to come with me. And so work out that narrative is important. And also because often you can't say this until you've already said this. You know, if I want to talk about in the state of lucid living, there's, you know, synchronicities happen. Well, you need to know what lucid living means, and you need to know what a synchronicity is. So before that, I need to have worked out those things. So that there's that kind of logic to it.
So another question I wanted to ask related to that was, when you're writing, who do you visualize your writing for? Because I know when we first did these interviews, you said it's a lot easier to talk when you've got someone there in front of you on the camera, on Skype or whatever, than it is just to talk to a camera, because it's relational. Okay. And I notice whether it's writing for an audience, it's much easier to write a letter than it is to write something that's for a general audience, I find, because I know who I'm relating to and I can think, well, will this person understand this? I know what their vocabulary is, what words they'll get and what they don't. But if I'm writing for a load of people, some people know what lucid living means, other people don't. Some people know all sorts of spiritual vocabulary, others don't. So how do you balance that? Do you visualize your writing for a particular person or at different times, or how do you do that?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the good things about that, the process I went through of writing a lot of those early books, was that I realized I was writing for a general readership, which is really going, look, I want this to reach everyone. And so it is tricky. I mean, if you look, you know, if someone's read the Mystery Experience, so they go to quite near the beginning of that, where I'm kind of, I know we're on a long journey because it's a big book. So I spend a whole, I don't know, section of the book going, hey, this is, if you're like this, there's going to be this. And if you're like, you know, if you're into the intellect, there's going to be lots of thoughts. If you're into feelings, we're going to do this. If you're a scientist, I'm going to talk about science. If you're a mystic, I'm going to talk about, because I'm wanting to bring everyone in. Other books, you know, like this one I'm writing at the moment, there's I will write this now. What? How am I thinking? I'm thinking I'm writing it because with a general sense of people, but I'm also going, but if you're not into philosophy, don't come with me, because this is going to be philosophy. I'm not going to make any, you know, this is not going to be ABC. This is going to be deep. And I want to, but my job, I always feel, is to know what I'm saying so clearly that I can make it clear enough that anyone or most people have a good chance of going, oh, I actually get it, rather than
right. Right. I remember you saying to me once, you were talking about another writer who writes spiritual books. I won't name him. But you said he's a very clever man, but he's not a very good writer because he lets his audience, his readership, know how intelligent he is when he writes. And a good writer lets the readers know how intelligent they are. And I think in your work, you do make concepts very accessible, like a book like Jesus and the Goddess, about Gnostic texts. Gnostic texts are famously inaccessible. You can't understand what they mean. And it would be very easy to write a book like that, which was equally inaccessible. And yet what you and Peter Gandy did in that was made a book on Gnosticism that a general audience could read. I mean, I was about 20 when I read that book and I could follow it. So how did you develop that style of accessibility? And were there people or other writers that influenced you in that? Or was it something that came about over just having been involved in writing for so long?
Wow, what a great question, Richard. I mean, it's very important to me. And I do think that. I think, like most people, when I used to read books, if I didn't understand them, I thought, I'm not clever enough. Now I just think the author's not writing well enough. Because the author... Or it's just not for me. I mean, if I'm writing a book on advanced quantum physics, then it's fair enough that I don't understand it because I need to put in the few years of work to get to that point. But if it's a book aimed at the general reader, then very often it's not oneself that's being stupid. It's the writer who's not really conveying the ideas. They think they know what they're saying, but they don't really know what they're saying. So I think it came out of my training at philosophy at university. What I loved about that, I mean, it was Western philosophy, really. I mean, most people find it very dry and very narrow. But what it did was it made me appreciate clarity of thought and the power of doubt and the ability to really go, what's this person saying? What am I saying? You know, just homing in, doubt. So I spend an enormous amount of time questioning my own ideas. And what that does is it helps me sharpen up the idea, and I won't rest until I find a way of saying it in a way that captures it, I feel, in a way that's accessible. So, for instance, lucid living I knew I wanted to write a book about the very essence of the mystical experience, and I knew I wanted it to be short. But I'd written 30,000 plus words, and in an attempt, I'd gone to Ireland to write it. I had a flat in Ireland by the sea, under the mountains of Mourne. Thing, how can I then stuff quotes from Zen masters and all sorts in there? That'll help throw that in a bit of that, and then just despaired and threw it in the bin and just thought, this is garbage. And literally in the bin, just went, what's that paragraph there? And pulled out this line, and there was a paragraph which just said the awakened state is it's comparable to lucid dreaming, it's like lucid living. And I was, the whole thing is there. That's it. That conveys everything. How you can be in the dream and not in it. The whole, you can be all one and all many. Everything was in, but it took all that time to find that. And then this tiny little book could come out in which I could just, but I knew that's where I was going. Mm-hmm. And so part of it for me is to go, no, that's not it. And be willing to pick up 3 months' work and throw it in the bin. No, that's not good enough.
Do you find that's been your experience of writing, that you have these phases of like writer's block, if you like, where you put loads down and then it's all scrapped? And because I mean, obviously when you approach a book now, you know you can write a book because you've done it 25 times or thereabouts. So but I think it's it can also be overwhelming for people just to hit this wall where they're trying to get out what they want to say and they can't quite. So do you, I mean, you've just described an example where you do, but is that a part of every book you write, that you will have periods of frustration and trying to overcome that? And how do you typically?
I get stuck. You know, I will get stuck with concepts. And in this present one, for instance, I'm trying not to write. I'm really pushing it. How long can I wait before I start writing? Because what I don't want to, what I find in the past often is I'm working on an idea and then there's something, there's like chapter three. Yeah, it's about that. It'll make sense when I get there. And then I get to chapter three and it doesn't make sense. And then suddenly it's like, oh God, how do I get through this? Or I get to chapter seven and realize that should have been chapter two. And then I've got to move it around. And then you've got all of this chaos that comes out. And a lot of writers get that. And that's a part of the process. I'm trying to avoid it with this one by really thinking it through first so I can. And part of it, I think, is that, you know, if you get stuck, it's valuable to have people to talk to because we're talking now. And in that interaction, sometimes it's easier to find the thoughts than when you're just sitting on your own.
Mm.
So it's good to, you know, good to remember. For me, here's the thing. And I say this very consciously in a lot of my books. At the beginning of The Mystery Experience, I quote Walt Whitman to try and get this across. When I write, I want the reader to feel like I'm writing to them because I am.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just them. Obviously, I'm reading writing for all these, but I am also writing just for them. I want them to hear my voice. I am saying to them, look, there's something of value that I'm willing to commit all of this time and effort into saying to you. And I want you to hear it's me. It's not just words on a page. It's not a book you downloaded or you bought. It's Tim. Tim is talking to you about his experience of being a human being alive on this mysterious journey of life. And so there's that kind of connecting through. I've forgotten your question now. I got carried away by connection. But that having someone to connect with so you can find the thoughts.
Yes. Okay. So, I mean, that's... So did you enjoy having a co-writer then in Peter Gandy or having people around that you can?
I have to have someone around always.
That's really interesting.
When I don't have a co-writer, there's always somebody that I can trust who I feel knows what I want to say and who will have the honesty to tell me when it's what works and what doesn't work. And, I need that. I have to have that.
No, that's because I don't think that would be obvious.
Not all through the process, though, Richard. Not it's not like always all the way through, but at key points, I want to be able to go. Is this working? This is what I want to try and say.
That's really interesting. I don't think that would be. It certainly wasn't obvious to me because I could visualize yourself or writers going into their office, locking the door, and it just. And then, I think it's if that's a person's image of what a writer does, and they try and replicate that, and it doesn't work, then because you need a more relational energy to be able to create something, it's very helpful, I think, to know that.
Yeah, because I tell you what it is: it's that you know you can try and work it out on your own, and sometimes you know, but sometimes you don't know, and then you can waste an awful lot of time. Does that work? Is that paragraph working? I got that little joke at the end there. Is that funny, or does that just make me sound like an idiot? If you're someone you trust, it takes you a second. They can just look at it, and if they go, "No, it works," you go, "Okay, it works." If they go, that makes you sound like an idiot, you just sort of cut that. And that ability, but it needs to be someone you trust who can mm-hmm. help you move into that. That's really what an editor should be. What an editor is in the modern age, isn't that? We publishing is a mess. Editors now are people you don't know. They come in, they mess with your books. They correct the grammar to their style. I don't like it. What an editor should be is someone who's there going, "Hey, Richard, I hear your vision. Let me help you get that vision onto the page." That's what.
Okay. So that's one pole of the kind of creative question in terms of having someone to relate to in the world. But you're writing about the mystical experience in these inner states of consciousness. So how does sinking into that, what role does that play in your creative process and writing?
I'm not someone who goes, yes, I come in the morning, I meditate for an hour, and then I can write. It's not like that for me. I don't know anyone who does that. There probably are people, but partly because there's something about meditation for me which is very still. So I'm more likely to just still everything right down and just be happy in the moment. I'm more likely to do, you know, like Tai Chi or something like that will often stimulate ideas. Again, you know, once you get it, it's really... well, it's just different for every all the time. For what I don't feel is that there's some sort of correlation between spiritual practices and creativity. Often okay. creativity will be frenzy. You know, a lot of my books have been like possessed. Like I'm just working through the night and a little bit crazy. And there's a craziness to the creative process I actually love. I mean, I do love it when suddenly it's just like you're in another world. And I do get, there is that of entering some other state where you are, especially when you're really in the process, holding a whole book in your imagination is like being 9 months pregnant. I mean, it's just, well, I don't know what that's like. Obviously I'm a man, but you know what I'm saying? It's like, I'm carrying this huge thing. And it's tough, and that's tough for people around me, because I'll come into the kitchen to make a cup of tea and Debbie or my kids will want my attention. And I'm like, no, no, just leave me. I'm just making tea and I'm holding this thing. Don't make me put it down. And I need to stay with it and get it out. So there's that much more like that than it is like, yes, I'm writing these words. The serenity is in the background. The serenity is where it comes from. But what comes out is this kind of passionate creativity.
Yeah, that's interesting, because what I'm getting at here is what I find when I'm writing something is that I'll put words down and look at them and not be happy with them. And I'm writing from the concepts that are in my mind. And when I sink within more and feel out, how do I really feel about this concept? What language would I put it in that's comfortable for me? Then that's what I want to say on the page. So that's what I'm trying to get at about the inner thing coming through.
Yes, absolutely. So my point earlier is, don't confuse that with
right.
Don't confuse those two. But yes, the deepness, the sinking back into the self. What is creativity? There's two things happening in this moment. There's the meeting of everything which has come before, which is repeating itself, and this newness, this possibility. The more conscious we are, the more creative we are. Simple as that. But don't confuse that with certain spiritual assumptions. But definitely, creativity for me comes from the depths of my being. So if I'm creating on the surface, it feels predictable and rigid and repetitive and where I've been before. But if I sink back, there's a tenderness to it. There's a directness. There's a risk taking. I'm startled by it. It all comes from that. And also for me, more than that, I spend an awful lot of time giving things over to my depths. So when I'm working on an idea and I can't work out how to answer it, I just let the question sink into the depths of my being and wait. So I do that a lot. So it's like, well, how does that? And then it'll go back, and then at some point over the next day or a week or whatever, yeah, or sometimes years, bang, up it will come. And then, that lovely feeling. You know that feeling of, ooh, this is good. I don't know what it is, but I know it's good. Hang on. I'm trying, you know. And there's that feeling.
Yeah, I heard you give an example once, actually, about an analogy to looking for the deepening of perspective, say, and the example you gave was like, right now all I can see is my hands, and yet paradoxically I can't actually see my hands, whereas if I move my perspective then I get a different view of my hands. I could see my hands in both places, but in a very different way. And that's what it feels like to me, of sinking back into consciousness. You gain you move further away from the issue, almost, of what you're trying to create, and can gain a more holistic perspective on it.
Absolutely. So in that way, it's absolutely integral. And so you really come out, and then it is all laid out, and you can see what it is. It is like watching something pour out, often. Like, oh, there it is. Now, not in the sense that, you know, everything's paralogical for me. So there's a create and there's a criticize involved in writing. There's two steps, so that the create is sink back, let it pour out the ideas, and that's a very spontaneous, intuitive process. And then there's another aspect which often will come in later, sometimes they come together, but often that's later, which is more critical, more really, does that work? Mm-hmm. Is that the best way of saying it? Should those come around the other, you know, should I put those sentences the opposite way around? Is that better? Does that? And then there's a different part of me which will come in, and there's a constant dance between those two, I think. We need both, but we don't need, we don't certainly want the critical one to dominate. A lot of people freeze because they've got the critical one on already. Mm-hmm. You've got to turn that one off. You've got to dance in the moment.
Well, that was my final point, actually, because I think there's a lot in modern self-development spirituality about getting rid of the critic, right? And an interesting thing about taking a dualistic or paralogical view, say, is that both of these halves of creative, critical, are necessary components of our being.
Yes.
Just when we don't recognize that, one can go totally out of balance, or it's suppressed and you don't know the critic's there, and then suddenly it rages up and will shred your work for you.
You need both. Course you do. But what you don't need is to let the it's like when I'm with my kids when they're little. I feel it with everyone. I feel like, look, the biggest thing to be being creative, and I've been so lucky, Richard. I've been so creative. All my life has been about creation. And the real secret at the center is being willing to be a fool. It's just being willing to make a mistake. Mm-hmm. You know, you just put it out there, you know, put it onto the page, you know, just be willing to, or if you're on a stage, say what it is you have to say. And if it doesn't work, go, oh, that didn't work, and move on. And it's that ability to just not hold yourself back, because that tightness prevents that intuitive flow of inspiration, which is there, which we can tap into. So my strong advice is, if you have something to say, be willing to sink back into it just as you describe and get it out, and then bring in the critic. Okay, where does this work? And if you can do that, like I say, when I'm philosophy walking, I'm doing both at once. Oh, there it comes. And then it's like, oh, let's have a look at that. And then there it comes. And then I'm just, and there's a movement between these things. If that I'm not good enough, what does that really mean? Oh, that's rubbish. If that comes in too early, you prevent yourself ever getting into the ecstatic state of pure creativity.
Right. So is perfectionism an enemy in that sense? That I'm insisting, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a real perfectionist, but just not at the start. And I want it to be as good as it can be, but the way for it to be as good as it possibly can be is not to come in with that at the beginning. It's a bit like you were mentioning Michelangelo earlier. If Michelangelo had started with his sketch and expected it to look like the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, he'd never have done it, because he'd be forever going, that's not it, that's not it. He did a sketch. As a sketch. And then he did the thing. And that's...
Okay, but to finish then, the final question I'll ask is, how do you finish? Do you need a deadline, or like where the book has to be sent off to the publisher and that sort of external pressure? Or would you, if it wasn't for that, would you carry on refining and refining indefinitely? Because I think for people that don't have deadlines, there can be a continuous polishing and a nether of actually coming into a fruition of the work. How do you find that?
Yeah, I think people do get that. I'm lucky I don't have that.
Right.
I don't need to work to a deadline. Well, it makes me work quicker and makes me feel like I've got to get on with it, I suppose. I know when a work's finished, and I know when it's not. And, you know, I've only ever been forced to deliver one book I knew wasn't finished, and I knew it wasn't finished, and we had to do an awful lot of work on it afterwards. Because I was over deadline, and it was a hugely ambitious book, and it was Jesus and the Goddess, actually.
Right.
And I knew I knew there was further to go with it. So I have a real sense of completion that it feels like, yeah, that's it. It's not, you know, it could always be more, but that has that's it. Now, what you do if you haven't got that, I think be clearer about what it is. You know, because often people don't complete because they don't know quite what they're doing. What are they trying to say? What are they trying to write? What does it look like? You can never arrive somewhere if you don't know where you're going. So the not arriving can be that you've not, you know, you haven't managed to achieve it yet, or it can often more likely be you didn't quite know where you were going. And also that our creativity is somewhere about some, you know, creativity in my life has been much about my own life journey as it has been about an end product. You know, I could look back now and I could go, God, I wasted 15 years creating hours of music, which no one will ever hear, and probably wasn't good enough in a lot of ways, much of it. But it doesn't feel like that, actually. Well, it does on my bleaker days, but no, it doesn't. That it feels like, no, it changed me. My soul is different for having gone through all of those states. That is who I am. So that sometimes we create things for ourselves to go through the experience, to be different at the end of it. Because when we create, it's the closest we get to being like God, if you like, you know, with a logical sense. You know, we get to be the universe bringing something brand new into the universe. And that's an extraordinary thing and something to be really appreciated.
Okay, well, I think we'll wrap it up on that note, Tim. Thank you very much for all that. And I feel, yes, inspired by that. So I hope it's helpful to people out there. Next time, because I always announce it in advance. Oh, by the way, thank you to everyone who commented on the Guru video. It was very interesting comments on the YouTube video linking off to sites of the Miraji, the Guru we were discussing. And next time, I thought we might talk about death and the bereavement process. Because, Tim, I know you did some work around that in your younger years. And it's not a period of your life I know much about. So I'd like to ask about how that influenced your later work and philosophy. So if anyone has any questions they'd like me to put to Tim on that, do leave them in the comments on the video or on Facebook. Okay, Tim, thank you very much.
Thanks, Richard. Later.